Starting your own private medical practice can be the most exciting and rewarding thing you'll ever do in your career, but at the same time, it can be so daunting. Where do you start and how? That's why Gentem Health put together the podcast series, Journey to Private Practice, where we document and interview entrepreneurs, clinicians, investors, and the best in the industry to bring you actionable insights as how to start, grow, and scale your private practice. With insights tailored just for you, and actionable links in the notes, this is the Journey to Private Practice. Hey, podcast listeners, another great episode for you with a very interesting guest. Now, this guest feels that the current U.S. healthcare industry is essentially terrible for both patient and doctor, and he didn't want an insurance company or hospital administrator telling him what to do and getting in the middle of the relationships that he built with his patients. And that person is Dr. Daniel Paul. He's a licensed physician in the state of Colorado with a full completion of a 5-year accredited orthopedic surgery residency. That's right. He is an orthopedic surgeon. And Dr. Paul, I first discovered him on LinkedIn because he was the first person that I saw talking about delivering care in the patient's home or in the primary care physician that they're at with. And he started a company called Easy Orthopedics, and you can check them out at easyorthopedics.com. And in this episode, Dr. Paul outlines his journey as to how, you know, when he left residency, how he decided to essentially not only start his own practice, but essentially the first mobile orthopedic practice, at least to my knowledge. So it's a great episode. I know you'll enjoy it. And for those of you who own a private practice and need a little bit of help with billing, reimbursement, and more importantly, driving revenue, check out Gentem. We do a fantastic job, and we're actually offering a free billing and revenue analysis. This is a $5,000 value. You get data, you identify where you might have leaking revenue, where you might need help, and a lot more. So head over to gentem.com/podcast demo. I'll leave that in the show notes and claim your demo and billing analysis. So with that being said, let's get on to the show. Hey, podcast listeners, Omar M. Khatib, your head of growth here at Gentem Health and host of Journey to Private Practice. We have a very special guest today, somebody who I just got connected to on LinkedIn and his story, and more importantly, the area of medicine that he's pioneering, and I know I'm putting him on the spot here a bit, is so compelling. I just had to have him on the show. And that's Dr. Daniel Paul. Dr. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Thanks for having me on the show. I'm doing all right.
Fantastic. Now, you know, Dr. Paul, you know, just to kind of tease the listeners a little bit, you know, today's show, it's going to be about this concept around mobile orthopedic care. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit of your origin story. Where did you grow up? What did you study in school? What got you into medicine, and why did you pick orthopedic surgery? Tell us about that.
Gotcha. So I really have two origin stories. One was kind of when the business really started being germinated and really what created. And then I have my own origin story of like why I got into orthopedics, which I guess is what you just asked me. So I come from a family of engineers. I think, you know, my dad was an engineer. His dad was an engineer. I have engineers on the other side of the family. So I have like a very engineering type mindset. And that's probably what I would have gone into had I not had a bad skiing accident when I was 14, where I skied into a tree. And luckily, I didn't die. I easily could have. And I broke both my femurs, my left hip fib and my right radius and ulna all at the same time. And, you know, I was in pretty bad shape for a while. I missed a lot of eighth grade. And if we're being honest, if you're going to miss any grade, eighth grade's a pretty good one to miss. But I missed a lot of it. And I went from being like totally messed up, can't really walk or do anything, to being able to move and walk around and run again. And actually, I ran track in high school. And I was like, this is so cool. I kind of got my life back. And I'm like, this is just the coolest thing. And it's so awesome. And I'm like, that's why I want to do orthopedics. And that journey, I mean, I just made that decision essentially when I was 14 years old, and then just kind of put my head to the grindstone and just kept going forwards to the point where in medical school, you know, I think orthopedics is tough to match into, especially as time moves on. And when I applied for the match, my dean was like, well, do you have any backups? I'm like, no. I'm like, if I don't do orthopedics, I'll just do something else with my life.
A real surgeon doesn't have backups.
No, I don't have backups. I'm not going to, I don't want to do general surgery. I don't want to do this and that. I'm like, I'll just do something else. Like, I'm just not going to be a doctor. Well, I guess, you know, I'll have the degree, but, and then luckily I matched and it worked out. So, I mean, that's kind of the desire of, you know, where it came to me that I wanted to do orthopedics. Now that's like origin story number one. Origin story number two is how did I come up with this practice? And, I never thought I would, right? If you talk to me in my cheap year as a resident, right, which wasn't too long ago, you would have said that. I would have looked at you with a, you know, funny face. So I said, I'm just going to get a standard job out in private practice somewhere and work. And I never had any idea or concept that I would do it. So what happened in the next year and a half? Well, I'll tell you what happened is I started fellowship, and I do general orthopedics now, but I started fellowship in hand surgery, and the fellowship, well, I won't go into too many details, but I'll just say this. Halfway through, two things happened. One is I had like a family personal crisis, and that was like mover number one. And then the second thing was I had an existential crisis at the same time. Now, my wife is from Colorado Springs, right? And that's where I am now. And I dragged her down to Florida, went to University of Miami, then University of Toledo, up in New York, and now to this fellowship. And I'm looking for a job somewhere out in Colorado. Not a crazy ask, right? I don't need to be in Colorado Springs, which is somewhere in the state that I want to settle and live in. And I can't find one. It's a competitive market. And it's like, here, take our entire level 3 call for our practice like 24/7. Or here's your 4-month guarantee and you need to build your old patient base. These are just kind of crazy jobs. And I'm like, these jobs seem terrible. And I interviewed for a job out in Connecticut, which is where I grew up and where I'm from. And it was like, man, this old senior partner was just telling me how much money he made in the early 90s. And like, he was just so bitter. And I talked to a junior attending there and I asked him, I'm like, are you happy here? And he said, well, it's getting better. I mean, that's what he said to me. It's getting better. What do you mean? Your whole life is going to be, it's getting better. And it just seemed like, you know, you make this decision when you're 15 years old, 14 years old, I'm doing orthopedics, and you just kind of go for it and you get through college and you get through medical school and residency. And then you lift your head up and you're like, oh my God, like, what am I doing? And look, I really like orthopedics, but it's not the practice of medicine you don't like. It's kind of the way you're forced to do it, working with these old, bitter seniors. Look, the way the medical ecosystem is right now, you either work for a really large private practice and these guys are conglomerating and getting bigger and bigger, or a giant hospital system. And that's just, it didn't seem like either of those would be a good fit. So at that point, I made some pretty rash decisions. I wouldn't say they're rash. I made some pretty significant decisions that I felt were the right things to do. And I just quit my fellowship, which is pretty unheard of in the world of orthopedics, right? You know, you do 4 years of med school and 5 years of residency and you have a 1-year fellowship. And like, why would you leave that halfway through? But that was just, I felt the right move to do. And I broke my lease and then I moved out to Colorado and I moved into my in-laws' basement, right? So I have my colleagues coming out of fellowship making, you know, mid 6 figures, and I'm here in the basement. It's just like, what am I, you know, I got to figure something out. And I had a friend who started a house call practice down in South Florida. He does internal medicine. And I would talk to him, you know, at first we laughed at him. We were like, what is this guy doing? You know, he's got a webpage, it's fancy, and he's marketing himself. And we would just kind of laugh at him while we were in residency. And then now I kind of light bulb went off. I'm like, man, this guy's not only happier than anybody I know, he's also doing better financially. So that was kind of, you know, I thought there was something there. And that made me want to look, well, okay, what does this look like for orthopedics? And I didn't know. And that's kind of been my journey over the past 2 years of figuring that out. But I mean, as you can see, if you're watching the video, I'm not in my in-law's basement anymore. So there's some level of success that I've had. But man, I've had to figure so many things out, you know, small things, like what do you do with your sharps, you know, to larger things like, okay, how do I, you know, do surgeries and where can I do them and this sort of thing. So I know I unloaded a lot of information on you, but that's kind of the origin story of how I became interested in orthopedics and then also how I pivoted to doing what I'm doing now, at least emotionally.
No, and I love that story, you know, and mainly because I think that, you know, when having having spent some time in medical school myself, that you're taught this concept of asking really good questions, right? When you're doing your patient exam. And I think a lot of physicians have gotten away from the idea of scrutinizing and asking questions of everything around them. And your question to that one practice, to that gentleman where you said, oh, are you happy here? And it's like, well, it's getting better. I think you asked the right questions that illuminated the harsh truth that this is not going to be the life for you to be happy. And the pain and risk of you figuring out on your own was not nearly as bad as the pain and risk of you being absolutely miserable, overworked and underpaid at these other other options. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, that was certainly part of it. And there's also an emotional component too, you know, where you look up after all this time of studying and working and everything, at least in training, I should say, and you're like, well, what am I doing? You know, right. But yeah, at its core, that's right. It just seemed like it wasn't the right move. And I'd rather go into the abyss of the unknown than stick with the known of something that where a majority of people seem to be miserable. And that was kind of the crux of it. So, I mean, why did I even start mobile? Well, I don't have the money for a practice. And that's how my friend started his practice. And so I got a bag and got everything in it. I started going around trying to figure out how to get patients, where to get patients, what do they look like, what do I do with them? And just kind of went from there. And the funny thing was, is that now I'm probably 50% house calls, 50% office visits. Well, I don't pay for any office space. I see people at other people's offices. I'll have chiropractors who will say, hey, can you see this guy in my office? Sure. I'm over at his office and I'm at another chiropractor's office. And actually there's an imaging center that I have space at as well that I can bounce in and out of. And if anybody needs any imaging, that, you know, if I'm there, that's where I'll send them. So X-ray, MRI, CT scan. There's always ways to figure these things out. It's just how much effort do you want to put into it? And can you be creative enough to do it? But I mean, yeah. I found solutions to things that problems that I thought just when you think you're not going to find a way to do it, something kind of comes through and works itself out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting is, again, what caught my eye, you know, your practice is called Easy Orthopedics. And it's mobile orthopedic practice. And, you know, even though we're in 2021, you know, the thing that hasn't changed as a surgeon, you still have to develop these relationships depending on where you are, because then you have to have those referral channels. The problem, though, is that, you know, somebody needs to refer a patient to their practice, they need to set up time and everything, versus what you've done is taken what the tech industry has done, which is to say, hey, we need to make everything mobile. I mean, DoorDash is valued at $50 billion for a reason, right? And you've taken that same business model and applied it to medicine, where the people who are going to be the lifeblood of your business, these referring practices, you're coming to them and thus making their practice better and offering a value to their patients, because the patient doesn't have to set up another appointment, wait 2 or 3, 4 weeks, you're there. So there's something about the personalization and convenience of this that is extremely compelling. And again, I've heard of mobile care in certain areas of medicine. This is the first time, forget about orthopedic care, this is the first time I've seen it in surgical care. So I feel like you're onto something. How long have you been doing this? And when did you have that aha moment where you say, I think I have something here that I gotta, you know, just go double down on?
The business I started in April of 2019. So about a little over 2 years now, it's been going and growing. I don't know if there was an aha moment. A lot of this was fueled by desperation, honest to God. I mean, if you talk to people who start their own businesses, it's usually not from a place of doing well, you know? Nobody starts a business like, hey, everything's going great, I'm gonna go start this business. No, that's not how it happens. It's, hey, these things aren't working, this is bad and that's terrible, and I don't know what I'm gonna do, and this seems like the best thing, I'm gonna try, and I don't know, if I fail, then I fail, and I'll do something else. That was kind of where it was. And the aha moment, it's been a series of learning, right? When I started, and I should say this as a caveat to what I'm doing, is I don't take any insurance at all. Zero, none. I'm not affiliated with any insurance companies. I opted out of Medicare. I don't take any. And why? And this kind of comes back to really one of the core of the business. The core of the business is that it's relationship-based care, which I actually told that to, I think, a biller one time, and she laughed in my face. That I, like, she really giggled at me, that I'm like, relationship-based care, that's when you can provide high quality care. But guess what? That's time dependent. You need to spend time with people to do that. If you pop in or out for 5 minutes, you may know the diagnosis and what the treatment is perfectly, but you're not taking into account what the patient's knowledge base is. There's no time for patient education. There's no ability to work with their social and economic constraints, or, you know, very limited time to deal with, you know, their emotional status on this. And so a lot of practices are like volume, volume, volume. How do we get our volume? Volume, volume, volume. Meanwhile, their overhead is ballooning out because you need to hire 5 people for every person, for every doctor in the practice. And sometimes it's more, sometimes it's a lot more because of all this billing and coding stuff that's floating around. So I flipped it on its head. Well, let's look at the overhead. How do we get that down to nothing? Well, if you don't take insurance, that cuts out like 90% of your overhead, cuts like you don't need any HR, you don't need space to keep all, you don't need any, like the staff, it cuts down your staffing cost tremendously. You don't need space to keep all the staff. And then it cuts down the cost of your EMR because now you need a much simpler EMR. And if you can remove the office too, I mean, your overhead is essentially, it's as low as it could possibly be. You pay for supplies of malpractice. And I feel that you're able to spend much more time with patients because you have a low overhead, lower volume practice. You don't see that many people. And I think the care is much higher quality, not because I'm a better doctor than I would have been in system, but just because I just have more time. There's just more time, more questions. And I think I can just do a better job with more time, you know, at least in the clinical setting. You know, the surgical setting, you want to be efficient and move. But I mean, in the clinical setting, you know, some people take a long time to help.
That's absolutely true. And there's only so much, I mean, again, these patient encounters, they're not as straightforward as what you learn in textbooks, right? And so it takes time to elicit the right information and dig deep. And I think that's absolutely right. I feel that medicine has done itself some favors in the last few decades by digitizing, using more data and everything, but it sort of skewed sometimes way too much on the science and data side and sort of lost the art side, which makes sense as to why there's like higher malpractice insurances, you know, people aren't happy and everything, because you can't, you know, this is a very personal thing, right? When you're ill, you know, there's only so much you can be efficient at when you're dealing with somebody who's in pain, who's ill, who's dying, you know, all the above. And I think you're absolutely right in saying that. So a lot of people who are, let's say, in residency who are hearing purely cash based, like this is a very big thing because there's a risk around it, right? What has been kind of like your bread and butter procedures and what does that look like when, you know, when you're dealing with a patient and getting them to go cash-based versus, let's say, using their insurance?
Man, there's no kind of, things are pretty variable. So, I mean, I do a fair amount of injections and I do those mobily as well. So I carry everything around to do injections, casting, splinting, suturing, wound care, but by and large, it's mostly injections. And I bring a little ultrasound around with me too, a little butterfly IQ, which if you're an ortho doc and you haven't learned ultrasound, you really have to, because you can visualize things like the cuff in real time, the SL ligament in real time.
They have great technology. You said butterfly IQ?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great tech. Great tech.
That's the one I use. So now I can do hip and sacroiliac joint injections. But it's just so variable. I mean, look, I'll give people the forms to submit insurance. And actually I've been seeing more people with insurance because their deductible is so high and they can't get in for 2 months. And I'm like, hey, I'll see you today or tomorrow. And that's kind of been, you know, that's worked out in that regard. But I don't think there's like a standard sort of thing that I see. I'll say this though, since I don't take Medicare, I'm not seeing your generally older population. Because, and I do see some people with Medicare and I've opted it out. They have to sign a form acknowledging that I've opted it out. But yeah, my patient population tends to be a little bit younger. And in the world of cash, it's totally different. I mean, you'll get someone for one visit and then they won't want to come back for a follow-up. The trauma you get tends to be a little bit older because, you know, they'll walk around with it for a while until it's really bad and then they get examined and told they need surgery. So it's a totally different kind of model. And when I say cash, people like to think I'm sort of, you know, just gaming after dollars, but that's really not what it's about. It's really about removing myself from insurance companies and not letting them dictate or tell me what I need to do, what I need to order. In the world of cash, for one MRI, we can get you one same day, next day, you know, for a few hundred dollars cash, which may be less than what you'd pay if you had insurance, which is just insanity. So, yeah, I don't know. It's all sorts of things. And I mean, like I say, it's just not insurance. I also see patients on medical lien, which means people are involved in car accidents. Even if I have to wait for 2 years to get paid, there's no billing involved in that. I don't need this massive overhead monster consuming all my time. And then, like, again, if I order an imaging study, they just get done. I mean, there's nothing stopping me there.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, patients, even physicians, I mean, we were speaking to Dr. John Eureka, who has a podcast called the Non-Clinical Physician Podcast about non-clinical careers and making money. And he even said it himself that he had to take his wife, I think, for an MRI. And when he asked a very straightforward question that anybody would ask when you're paying for anything, which is he asked the imaging center, well, how much is this going to cost? And they were like, well, we're not sure. It, you know, there's this and that and everything. And then they just said, you know what? We're just going to go to a cash-based one and pay for it. Because even though as a consumer, as a patient, you might pay more or less, at least you know what you're going to be in for, versus going in blindly into these imaging centers or procedures. And it's like, you don't know what you're going to be given, you know? And I think that more and more, as like models like yours proliferate in the market, the end user being patients gets more educated about, well, you know, there are other options. Because prior to the last, I think, 5 or 10 years, everybody's thought about medicine was like, okay, I need to get insurance. And when something happens, I just go and see a doctor or go to the hospital. And then I wait and see what happens and see how much I get paid or how much I end up owing. But I think these new models are going to inspire a lot of patients to consider, do I want to be surprised by a massive bill, or do I want to know exactly what I'm going to pay for up ahead and then maybe finance it?
Right. So it's a mentality change, right? So insurance has been around since World War II, when they did wage freezes, and employers said, hey, we need to incentivize our employees, so we'll provide major medical care. Now, back at that time, if you went to the hospital, you either died or you didn't. There wasn't a whole lot of intervention they can do. And it's kind of just morphed and really gotten crazy to the point where now have you all this mentality, like, I need insurance, they need to pay for everything. But your insurance on other parts of your life doesn't pay for everything. I mean, if you bust a tire or something on your car insurance isn't paying for that. But we're so locked into this mentality that it's hard to kind of peel people away from that. I think more people are, as insurance gets worse and worse, starting to think about things differently. And that, hey, maybe I don't need it. Maybe I can find other ways of doing it. And that's the kind of the space where I occupy, where people have the misconception that, like, oh, he's a concierge doctor seeing just really rich people. First of all, I'm not a concierge doctor. A concierge doctor
usually
They double dip, exactly. So this is a common misconception, which is an understandable misconception that, oh, this guy just sees really rich people in his house, you know, in their houses and whatever. And that's not what I do. Not really, at least. It's happened, but it's not on the regular. But yeah, concierge doctors, they bill your insurance and then they bill you on top of that separate. And a lot of primary care doctors do that, or some do, in order to keep their patient panel down low. They're basically saying, hey, our overhead is so high that you need to make up for it by these extra payments so that we can actually provide you the care that we should have been providing in the first place. Compare that with direct contracting, like your direct primary care doctor. They say, hey, we don't take any insurance, you just pay us only. And actually, a lot of times they're much less expensive. So I'm more in the direct contracting model. So I guess you could call it direct orthopedic care. I don't know if there's a better name for it, but I think I'm the only one doing it. So I guess I'll call it whatever I want right now. but you know, that's a slight difference there.
You know, so when you were getting started, what was it like for you? Because you had to get started somewhere with somebody. So, you know, when you reached out to referrers such as like chiropractors or other physicians, what essentially was your pitch to them? And then what does your day-to-day kind of look like when you're seeing patients?
Gotcha. So, man, when I started, I had no idea. No one's done this before. So I don't know what it looks like. So I'm like, I had to just think of things and try them out. So my very first day, I was in a suit. You know, people don't really wear suits here out in Colorado. And I figured I'd learn that by now. I'm in scrubs all the time. But in my suit, I've got my bag, folded all my stuff. I look good. And I'm like, you know, hotels. I'm like, hotels got to be it. People come from in out of town, they get hurt. The hotel staff will probably love to recommend, oh, this doctor will just come to the hotel. all right, makes sense in theory, until I go into the lobby of one of the nicer hotels in town, and they're like, they just wanted me to leave. Like, I could tell I was like a salesman of sorts. Like, the energy wasn't good. It was bad juju. And I gave them cards. I'm sure those cards ended up in the garbage. Like,
welcome to the life, brother.
Yeah, immediately. So, you know, it's like, okay, that was day one. We're like, first day, I'm like, well, that didn't work. Who else? Well, how about CrossFit? I'm like, oh, these guys get hurt all the time. So I go to CrossFit gyms, and they're, you know, they're super nice. They sit down, talk with the owner, and they're super cool. And then I never got a referral from them ever. And I'm like, oh, CrossFit people don't like to go see the doctor ever, because all I'm going to do is tell them you can't do CrossFit. And that's really bad. So that was out. And it was kind of just calling people. I started doing local networking groups, working on my search engine optimization. And then I kind of started to find a rhythm of things like, okay, these people will actually refer to me, and like, I can't add value. And like, I'm all mobile, and someone's like, well, hey, can you stop by my office? I'm like, oh, I can do that. And I'm like, oh, this works pretty well. And they liked it, and I liked it, and the patient liked it. And then it started just going from there. So, you know, some of my I have a certain referral base where I get people from. And then also some just find me on the internet, and we make it work. So it's all over the place. It's evolving. I mean, if I could go back in time and tell myself 2 years ago, I think I would have been able to grow the business much faster, because I've been like, don't waste time with A, B, C, D, E, F, or G. You know, here's what works.
And what's been your bread and butter procedure, more or less? Like, what's for a mobile orthopedic surgeon, what's been the bread and butter for you so far?
I don't think I can really answer that question. It just just depends on kind of what comes in. I mean, I just want to clarify, surgeries are not mobile, right? They're in a surgical center. But the surgeries right now are few and far between. I just kind of get them as I do them, you know, as my business grows. So most orthopedic surgeons, most of the revenue is from probably surgical procedures. Mine's not.
So yours is actually from patients, from seeing patients in consults?
Yeah.
This is fascinating. And what I like is that the term flipping it on its head is often thrown around, but in this case, you're very much doing that, because as a surgeon, like you've introduced a very interesting business model, and I would say a clinical model too, which is you're focused more on the patient care, and you mentioned earlier when we were discussing a term that you used with the biller. What was that term again? The term that you used with the biller, that it was more relationship-based care.
Yes, relationship-based care. So that's what direct primary care doctors use. And for a doctor, it's much more enjoyable to practice like that, because that's why you went to medical school in the first place. And so people aren't just a bunch of collection of arms and legs. I mean, they're people, and it's about establishing that connection and helping them when they need you. And in these 5-10 minute visits, that's transactional. You can't do that. And I think that kind of takes the real positive part of medicine out of it for the doc. And that, I think, contributes to burnout, right? There's some things that are worthwhile transactional, right? You go buy clothes at a store, you order a pizza, that's transactional. And that should be transactional, and that's fine. But when you're dealing with a doctor, someone's trying to get you better, that's a relationship-based game. And the relationship part's been sucked out of it. So I just put it back in and essentially removed all the middlemen surrounding it. Because what do you really need in a doctor-patient relationship? Well, you need a doctor, you know, a provider, and you need a patient. And then it turns out you really don't need much else. If you have those two things, it'll work. And look, this business model, it seems new, but it's actually really old.
It's traditional medicine. That's exactly what it was.
I think in the 30s, it was like, you know, a third of all visits were all house calls, and people liked them. I mean, I'll see patients today, they're like, oh, I remember when the doctor saw me when I was 6 years old, you know, and you know, they're in their 60s or 70s now, but people like that, and the doctors liked it too, and it made sense. So I'm just I'm kind of going back to that model, but with a new twist on it.
Yeah, and again, what I think is interesting is that the timing of it is really good, because you know, COVID accelerated a lot of trends that were already happening. Like, people were already working from home, but people, you know, companies weren't 100% bought into it. You know, there were companies that are already doing delivery, all these different things. And so, you know, engineering your life around everything at home, I think, is huge. I mean, look, my wife and I the other day,
when we're thinking about services, you know, my wife needed something for, you know, like a massage for her neck. And I was like, hey, we should check and see if there's like either a chiropractor or a massage therapist we can just come to the house. I mean, we can go see them, but it's so much more convenient and better. And I think that that model, while it's traditional and old, I think it's a lot more effective. And, you know, there's something to be said about, you know, the fact that you're focusing so much on relationships, because, you know, at the end of the day, when I go see a physician, it is about a relationship. And a lot of times, you know, when people talk about the doctor they love, yeah, part of it is like the work that they did and the results, but a lot of it's based on the care, right? And that's relationship based. And you can't establish a relationship with somebody if you're being rushed through that process. And on top of it, you know, I think clinicians, they love this idea. Like, I used to get excited when you see a patient, asking the questions to kind of dig deep and say, you know what, I'm going to ask the right questions. Like, I'm going to figure out like, what exactly is it that's going on here? It's hard to do that when in the back of your head is, well, how am I going to justify this to an insurance company? And then I'm going to talk to somebody who may or may not be a doctor, and they're going to tell me what I'm allowed to do or not. Right. It takes the art out of medicine and the effective part of medicine completely out of it.
Yeah. And I've essentially removed them. So I don't need to talk to anybody before I do anything. It's just, we're in the world of cash.
How empowering is that, by the way? Like,
oh, it's wonderful. I mean, I really enjoy seeing my patients. I mean, they have my phone number too. They call, if they have a question, I encourage them to call me. And this is another one of those things, right? The benefits from the type of my type of model is, why should you have to call the front desk who talks to the medical assistant, who then talks to the doctor, which goes back to the medical assistant to answer your question? The doctor has to answer it anyways. Just talk to me directly. And they do, they'll call and text me, and I think that's added service I can provide. But yeah, the relationship part is such a huge core of medicine in general. It's really been sucked out and removed, and continues to be so as overhead goes up, like from all these billing and insurance requirements, and reimbursements go down. So even these very large private practice groups who are busting at the gills of volume are being forced to conglomerate because they can't stay solvent. Well, your whole model is based on how much you're getting reimbursed from these people who decide how much to pay you. Once Medicare sets a price trend, the other insurances follow it. And, you know, if you total joint guy, you know, they could slash total joints in half tomorrow. And what's your recourse? Do more? Yeah. Well, there's only so much you can physically do. And I think everybody's kind of being squeezed that way. I've removed myself from that. I can charge what I think is reasonable. People can decide to pay me or not pay me. And look, there's a lot of people who, small business owners, they don't have insurance, or their deductible is too high, or, you know, their network is so narrow, and I end up being a good, actually more economical solution for them, you know, as far as cost containment, because when I see them, I have more time on my visit, and we can take economics into consideration. Well, what can you actually afford to do, and what can't you do? And how can we make this work for you? You can't afford physical therapy? Let me send you these home exercises, because that's better than me giving you a script for physical therapy and you're doing nothing. And then we can have some really nice wins on the surgical side as well. And not too long ago, I was able to do a distal radius all in for $6,500, which included anesthesia facility.
Wow.
And implant. Now, can I do that again? I don't know. Is that the right price? I don't know. But we can easily shift things around. There's no one telling me what I can or can't do. And the patient, the hospital quoted him like $27,000 plus facility plus anesthesia. He was never going to do it. And he was a 40-year-old roofer, you know. And now he's doing great. But there's just a lot more nuances to it. And doctors like to disconnect themselves from the economics of the situation. I think in today, you really have to take that into consideration when you're treating a patient. And back to the relationship part, the only way a doctor today in system develops a relationship is when they see a person like 10 times, or, you know, as 10 times as 7 minutes, you get eventual an hour of FaceTime, and then the relationship starts to develop. So, you know, and meanwhile, I'm seeing them for 45 minutes, an hour, first time the relationship develops, and they call me. So it's just a different way of looking at it. But, you know, look, doctors are unhappy. Even these orthopedic surgeons have these million-dollar practices. They're just seeing their revenues decrease year by year, and their overhead going up year by year, and they're miserable. And I mean, it's very baseline. I mean, my model is almost the realistic, it's like a real life example of the 4-hour work week in a lot of ways.
I love the Tim Ferriss reference, 100%. No, 100%. And, you know, what I think also is very interesting is that, you know, this concept that you have, because at the end of the day, it's not about money, it's about freedom, right? And freedom means you have a choice. And so even you're right that even a lot of these larger practices that are making a lot of money, they, you know, they Medicare and CMS can slash reimbursements tomorrow. Like, what are you gonna? Yeah, there's nothing to do. There's literally nothing to do.
You know? You're stuck.
Yeah, yes, exactly. You're stuck. Do you feel like a lot of physicians are like that? They're literally just stuck, and their option is just like, you know, I'm just gonna work harder.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's another option too, which is far darker, is that a lot of them end up committing suicide or dying by suicide, I should say. They find no way out. The suicide rate's really high and they can't do it anymore. And then that's their solution, which is really, really terrible.
Yeah. And nobody's talking about that. It's going up. Burnout and suicide among physicians is going up every single year. I read a statistic the other day that for every 100,000, there's like, three or four physician deaths. Essentially, the number of physician suicides compared to the general population is like 30% higher, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and you can see why, right? You go to school and you want to help people, and this is what you want to do for the majority of people. And then you're not really allowed to do that, where you're forced to see people in short periods of time. Oh, insurance tells you what to do. Hospital administration tells you what to do. You're not forming any relationships with your patients, and you feel that you can't do a good job. And that's what you want to do. And it causes this sort of moral injury, leads to depression, goes untreated. And like, you know, the end stage of depression sometimes is suicide. And that's where they get it. It's super sad. You know, these are people that are pretty mentally resilient, and at least before they start this, and they just get worn down to a pulp. I mean, you talk to these older doctors and man, some of them are so miserable. I mean, so the real wonderful thing about my model is I'm very happy doing it. I mean, I have a lot of free time to spend with my family and do the things I want to do. And, you know, like if I wasn't busy a few Wednesdays ago, I went to the zoo with my wife and daughter. And you can't put a price on that stuff. And so even when I started and I wasn't busy and I'm in the basement rubbing two sticks together, I was still much happier than I'd been in a very long time.
I think that's what it's about, because at the end of the day, if you don't, and excuse me one second while I close the door, I don't know what my wife is doing, but it's a really loud noise. Let me close the door real quick. Okay. Sorry, everybody, for that. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think at the end of the day, you know, whether you're a physician or in any other profession, you're going to be a lot more effective if you're happier. You know, and if you're happy, you're going to deliver a much better service. I just feel like there's people don't ask the question that you asked early on when you were looking for a job, which was, are you happy here? And that, you know, that other physicians are like, well, it's getting better, because I think so much gets mapped back to that. But we get so focused on other things and distracted by shiny objects that we forget that, you know, you're probably better off making 20, 30% less money, not in your case. I'm just saying in general, you're better off. I mean, I'll use myself as an example. I know that I'm probably making at least a quarter, if not a little bit more, less money, because I mainly work in startups, but I'm a lot happier. It's fulfilling to me. And more importantly, I'm doing exactly the things that I want to do, versus if I go work, no offense, to like at a J&J or Medtronic or one of these larger companies, yeah, I'll get paid more money. I'll probably have an easier life because of the responsibilities. You know, you're not working as much, in my opinion, but I'll be miserable. Like, I will absolutely be miserable, you know? And I think a lot of people don't take that into account.
You can't put a price on that. You can't put a price on that. You know, what are you going to do? Work till you're 65, counting down the days, and then retire and die a year later? I mean, I saw a doctor who was in that fellowship before I quit, and he was about to retire. And people ask him, how many days do you have left? And he's like 60, 63, 62, 61. To everyone, it was a joke, but this guy's miserable. I mean, if he's counting down the days, he's probably counting down the months and years. And it's like, how long has this guy been miserable? And you don't know how much time you have on this earth. And it happens where people retire right after, they die right after they retire. Then what's the point of everything? I think that kind of harkens back to my existential crisis that I had when I had it. Now, most doctors tend to have that in the middle of their careers. I just had mine at the beginning. which I think was a blessing in some ways for sure.
Yeah. And just because, you know, it sounds like you know, especially because of the results and the success you've had, it sounds like you read some stuff from Tim Ferriss. And Tim Ferriss has a great quote that he pulled some from Eastern philosopher, which was, you know, the quality of your life is going to be reflected in the quality of questions you ask yourself. And I think you've done just that. As we wrap up, and again, I appreciate you being very gracious with your time. I have a couple other questions left, and then we're going to get to a rapid fire segment where I ask you some questions. You get to answer them as quickly as possible, and then we'll move on to them. You can take as long or as short. Last question before we get to rapid fire. You know, in the tech world, like let's say with marketers, we have like what's called a tech stack. You know, what's the tech stack of tools you like to use? So for you, being a mobile orthopedic surgeon, what's your tech stack? You mentioned there's a lighter EHR you get to use. What's kind of like that go-to tech stack where if another surgeon's listening to this and saying, you know what, I want to do this, what's that tech stack you recommend to them?
It's my practice is ultra lean and minimalist. So you got to ask yourself why things are the way they are. Why do all doctors hate EMRs? Well, it's not because we hate technology. It's because it's click boxes. They're billing machines. They're not note-taking machines. So doctors, they turn a doctor into a biller. Well, we don't want to be billers. That's not what we went to school for. It's not what we want to do. And that's why they hate them. But you remove insurance from the situation. You just need a note. That's a note. And, you know, I've even had some lawyers look at my notes and they're good because they're readable. So I use a HIPAA compliant Google Workspace. You're talking $12 a month per user and you can template all these Word documents. So that's dirt cheap. I mean, you know, even the medical supplies I need to carry around for orthopedic stuff, none of that's super expensive. The most expensive piece of equipment I have is probably the ultrasounds. The mobile ultrasound is huge. I have models on my iPad. I'll show them my models. You know, we're pretty implemented in the world of Google. So, you know, we'll use Google Voice. Man, but like, it's pretty bare bones. I mean, you need a medical license, DA license, and malpractice. And then some basic supplies, super simple EMR. Website's good. I've got one of those as well. Gosh, I really don't. It's like as minimalist as you possibly can get. And I mean, I'll carry different things around. I don't always carry my cast part. But if I cast someone, I'll put it in my trunk. You know, I have a cast saw that I'll put in there as well. You know, over time, I've acquired surgical equipment. Like I own a full size C-arm now, that's mine. Just various things here and there. But man, you'll need a lot.
Where does your C-arm live?
It lives in the surgery center.
Oh, got it. I'm not going to lie. I was kind of picturing that you had this big van and it had kind of like a transformer thing going on. You know what? In a few years, that's the investment. As this blows up, you're going to have like that mobile transformer orthopedic care unit.
You know, it's funny you say that because I had a patient who she couldn't get vaccinated because immunocompromised, but she didn't want to go inside any buildings. So what we had her do is I actually saw her in my own backyard. Then I had a mobile x-ray company come. So we're in my backyard and he's taking x-rays and I treated her just in my backyard. There's just, when you open your mind up, there's so many things that we do that we think you need to do that you really don't need to do. And that's mostly everything. I mean, I'm not even affiliated with any hospitals. I don't go inside them. My wife recently had a baby. So that's the last time I was in a hospital. Before that though, the last time I've worked in a hospital, it's been years. They're just not an important part of the conversation, at least in my practice.
That's amazing. There's so many like very interesting insights from this. I feel like a lot of surgeons who listen to this podcast are just going to be, I'm just telling you right now, you're going to be a repeat guest on this show as far as I'm concerned. So with that being said, let's get into the rapid fire question. I got three for you. You can take as short or as long as you want to answer them. Okay. So here's the first one, kind of an easy one. You know, in the world of medicine, continuing education is very big. By accident that a lot of physicians have a lot of other interests outside of medicine, are very well read. What's a book that you feel that you gift or recommend most often to others, and how did that make an impact on you?
So I read a lot. You know, if you're listening to this podcast and you don't have a library card, like you need to get a library card. My gosh, you get a Kindle and you get a library card. You don't actually need to go into the library. And I think I'm the last one at this party. Maybe not though. It just sends the books right to your hand. And then what I do, I don't know if I should say it. Well, I put my phone in airplane mode so I can have it as long as I want. But the book I'd recommend, it's called The Innovator's Prescription by Clay Christensen. Have you heard of it?
Yep, absolutely.
So it's the author who wrote the, I think it's the
Innovator's Dilemma.
An Innovator's Dilemma, right? And yep. He kind of turned an eye on medicine, kind of what the future looks like. And there's so many good insights in that book that it's just, I highly recommend reading it. It's excellent.
Fantastic. So that's the Innovator's Prescription, you said, correct?
Innovator's Prescription, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Got it. Absolutely. So that's one. Next question for you. You know, along the way, in high school, university training, you know, you've probably had mentors, you know, who have coached you and provide you insight and guidance. What is the most painful thing a mentor ever told you, and how did that change you?
Gosh, man, the mentor ever told me. It's, this is going to sound weird, but I have some mentors, but I really don't have any. I shouldn't say that for sure. I have people that I get advice from. I would not consider any of them really mentors.
Yeah, maybe not a mentor, but just a painful piece of advice someone gave you that changed you. It could be a parent, it could be anybody.
Man, it's hard to, you got to give me a minute to think about this one. I don't know. I can't tell you. And the reason why I can't tell you is because I just don't know.
That totally okay. If you think of something, we'll come back to it. All right. So last question for you. I want you to imagine that for the next year, Gentem takes out a billboard in front of every medical practice throughout the United States. Every orthopedic surgeon in training and in practice and everything, they're gonna see this billboard as they walk in. And actually, let me extend it out. Every physician is going to see this. What message would you put on that billboard?
I think I would say, want the ability to say F you to hospitals and insurance companies. There's another way. That's it.
I love it.
That's what it comes down to. I have the ability to tell them to just screw off. And that to me is worth its weight in gold.
I completely agree. And I think deep down inside, physician or not, everybody's trying to get to that point where they have the quote unquote, like FU money, you know? But you know, having that kind of opportunity to have that freedom, I think a lot of physicians are going to listen to this. It's going to give them something really, really to think about, because, you know, even with Gentem, for what we do, our customers, when I talk to them, there is always this frustration because, you know, patients and diagnoses don't fit within a drop-down menu. And, you know, I think that every physician has a frustration that they spend all this time training and getting education and everything, and they have to justify what they do to a drop-down menu and someone on the other end of the phone who's not even a peer, you know? And I can only imagine how bad that is.
It is terrible. It really sucks the life out of you. And to answer your mentor question, I think one of the reasons why, I mean, I have general people, I trust their advice and I listen to them. And they tell me about one thing or another, but I don't really talk to any other ortho docs. I'm sure if I told them I was going to do this model, they'd all tell me I was dumb and an idiot and that'll never work. So I don't have any of these highly esteemed, you know, orthopedic surgeons being like, oh, you should do A, B, or C, because they would all tell me what I'm doing is super stupid. And it's not. And, I just think I'm just that far out of left field that I don't know what, it's just no one else is out here with me. I'm just having to figure everything out, at least in the world of orthopedics.
Well, it's extremely admirable. I'm going to leave links to show notes below. I know you have a website, easyorthopedics.com, but aside from that, how else can people, you know, find you? I know there are going to be a lot of people who want to connect and follow you on this journey. Where else can people find you online?
I have a Twitter, EasyOrtho1, or you can find me on LinkedIn as well. I have a YouTube channel as well that I'll post videos to, mostly medical stuff, though occasionally something business related. But if you have a contact form on our website, and if you submit there, you know, I'll always get that message. And, you know, depending on what you're looking for, you know, we can have a chat or whatnot. And I don't know, just take things as they come. I get a lot of sales pitches, so if I don't respond, I apologize.
Yeah. It's leave it to marketers and salespeople. We end up ruining everything. So that's happening on LinkedIn all the time. But, and you're based in the state of Colorado, correct?
Yeah, although I do telehealth in about a dozen other states.
Fantastic. So then for all our listeners who are probably going to be inquiring about that, you can go ahead and check out the website and reach out to him. So Dr. Paul, stay on for a few minutes. We'll chat right now. This has been another episode of Journey of Private Practice. I'm your host, Omar Mkhatib, and we'll see you all next time. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Journey to Private Practice. If you like the show, hey, help other medical practice owners like yourself discover it. Please leave us a 5-star review, say a few nice things, and if anything, send this episode to somebody else, because I don't know about you, but for me, anytime anything good has happened in my life, it's been as a result of other people helping me. So forward this on, pay it forward, and we'll see you next time.